Viva Doobie, featuring Klatto. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to Sudan, which is facing the world's largest humanitarian crisis as it enters its third year of a devastating civil war between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. Tens of thousands have died and some 13 million have been forcibly displaced. There are also widespread reports of sexual and ethnically motivated violence and a worsening hunger crisis. On Tuesday, officials from 20 countries gathered in London at a high-level international conference chaired by the UK, the EU, and African Union to find a pathway to peace. But talks have reportedly collapsed. In Sudan's western Darfur region, the UN reports attacks by the RSF last weekend killed at least 300 people in refugee camps as paramilitaries took control of the Zamzam camp, which had housed some 500,000 people. The NGO Relief International said 9 employees, the entire staff of the camp's only remaining health clinic, were killed in the attack, along with at least 100 others, including children. Some 400,000 additional people are believed to have been displaced in the area just over the last few days.
We're joined now by two guests. In Oslo, Jan Egeland is with us, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, and Emital Mahmoud, a Sudanese-American world champion slam poet from Darfur and Philadelphia, born in Khartoum. She's also a humanitarian activist and former refugee. Her new piece for DevEx is headlined in Sudan, "The Power Must Go to Its People, Not to the People in Power." We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Emmy Mahmoud, describe what's happening in Darfur. Describe what's happening in Sudan, as at this point, we enter the third year of this civil war between the paramilitary forces and the government.
Thank you so much for having us. It's so harrowing to describe. My family have lived in Zamzam camp, which is now completely destroyed, for almost 20 years. And the other half of my family is from Al-Fashir, which is now has been under siege for almost over a year. And what's so terrifying about what happened is that an IDP camp is an internally displaced person camp. This is supposed to be a place of refuge. But on Sunday and in the days before, the RSF brutally attacked the camp, killing more than 400 people by our count on the ground. They tortured and killed women and children, and they kidnapped 58 of the girls in my extended family, and we are still searching for them. We cannot find them. We have not seen them since Sunday. This brutality is something that we've seen during the Darfur genocide, and we've seen over and over again in this war and in many of the years from the start of this of the genocide and counting. I think that entering the third year of war, we should not be terrified and confused about whether or not the international community is going to act to stop the Al-Fashir massacre from happening. We warned that the Zamzam massacre would be happening because the MSF reported a child dies every 2 hours from the man-made famine due to the siege. And now we're warning that the Al-Fashir massacre will happen as we actively try to evacuate people. Aid is in huge shortage, and we're not able to move international aid into Al-Fashir, or we were not able to move it into Zamzam either because the RSF will not let it pass. So currently, we're doing everything that we can through small donors and family members and community to continue moving our people who have now been 4 times displaced, including my family members, many who have been killed and many who are still missing. And the injured are bleeding out without any care. So we're moving as fast as we can, but we need the world to pay attention.
I mean, we're so sorry for the suffering of your family and your family members who have been killed in this horrific war. If you could just kind of give us a quick sense of, you know, how was this 2 years ago? How and why did this war begin between the government forces and the RSF? What's at stake?
Thank you for the question. The RSF is the Rapid Support Forces, and it's the latest iteration of the Janjaweed who terrorized Darfur for decades. And the SAF is the Sudanese Armed Forces. Now, the Sudanese Armed Forces created the Janjaweed and institutionalized the RSF under Bashir, the former dictator. So in 2018 and 2019, there was a lot of movement by the youth, including a lot of us from Darfur who walked for 1,000 kilometers, mobilizing thousands across the way and reaching Khartoum to inspire a collective responsibility for peace. Just a couple months after our peace walk in 2018, I was in Sudan to do it all over again in December, and that's when the revolution started. Now, the revolution was a peaceful revolution led by young people, led by women, and people called for an end to more than 30 years of dictatorship and horrible, horrible genocides, plural, including what happened in South Sudan in 21-year civil war. So in 2019, the world was very inspired, and people said, blue for Sudan, and the people in Khartoum said, Al-unsur al-maghroor kull al-balad Darfur, which means you racist, you hypocrite, the entire country is Darfur. So they heard our cry, and that was to the dictator. In 2019, the dictator fell, and there was a moment of hope, but you know, there were these massacres of young people. They were sitting with sit-ins and peacefully just trying to push for democracy, which is something that we've all hoped for and prayed for, and that's something that's part of our culture. We're very democratic as indigenous people in Sudan and in Sudan in general. And then in 2019, hundreds were killed and thrown into the Nile, hundreds of children and young people in Khartoum who, I say children, but they were young people who were pushing. And I do say children because my cousin Mohammed, he was 15 years old when he was killed in January in 2019 at the beginning of the revolution. So many people were killed and thrown in the Nile. Many are still missing. So then in 2021, the RSF and the SAF cooperated to overthrow the civilian transition. So a civilian transitionary government was put in place with a deal that would be, you know, it would spend 3 years, and in the first couple of years, the military would be in power, which us young people said, do not make this deal. Do not cooperate with SAF and RSF, who are both liable for genocide in Darfur and other regions. But they did cooperate. And then in 2021, RSF and SAF cooperated for a coup that overthrew the civilian government and any hope for a peaceful transition. And then now in 2023, 2 years ago, right as we were getting ready for Eid Ramadan, the massacre began. This war is not a civil war, according to people on the ground. It is a war against the people because we do not consent to this war. So to make it very simple, you have two warring parties who used to cooperate to commit genocide and to, you know, massacre our people. And now they fell out and are having this power struggle. And they're trying desperately to cling on to power. And they're being funded by many nations, rich nations, on both sides. And I say this as somebody who thinks that there should be zero tolerance for genocide. I understand that right now the RSF is the biggest danger for us in Darfur and all over the country. They've used sexual violence as a weapon of war. And the UNICEF reports that 12 million people are at risk of gender-based violence, and they're often repeatedly subject to the same thing. And they've created man-made famine, they've laid siege, they've done so many different things that are acts that constitute war crimes. The SAF has done the same. But the reality is the RSF and the SAF, they both need to be held accountable to stop this war, and their funders need to be held accountable too.
Well, we'd like to bring in Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. Jan, you've also said that this is the darkest hour for Sudan. If you could talk about the worsening humanitarian crisis in the midst of this horrific war and how much worse that humanitarian crisis has been made by cuts in U.S. aid funding as well as among EU donors.
It is by far the worst displacement crisis in the world. 15 million people now displaced by violence. I've been there twice now during this last 2 years of war, and you see devastation everywhere, really. But we are many groups on the ground. Norwegian Refugee Council is in West Darfur, in North Darfur, in South Darfur, where in Tawila, to where people now flee from the Samsam camp. We try to provide as much relief as we can. But indeed, aid is scarce. And it's beyond me that when I was in the UN in 2003, I mean, 22 years ago, during the first Darfur crisis, this was on the agenda of President Bush of the United States, Prime Minister Blair of the United Kingdom, of the European Commission. We did not lack funding, and we could scale up with a large aid operation. Today, many more are displaced than at that time. More people starve, and there is silence, really, and little funding. The U.S., being the largest historically to Sudan, suspended all aid to all countries on the 20th of January, including to us and in Sudan. Now we hope we will get back at least some of it, hopefully most of it, but there were months with no pipeline for Darfur and Sudan.
Well, we also want to ask Jan Egeland, since you've recently returned from the Democratic Republic of Congo, you know, what the situation on the ground there is. President Trump's senior advisor for Africa has just finished a tour of several East African nations, including the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, where he discussed a peace deal that could involve the U.S. tapping its rich mineral resources in the war-torn east of the country, including cobalt and lithium. This is Massad Boulous speaking last weekend in Kigali, Rwanda, which neighbors the DRC.
I can confirm and I can affirm that the United States also remains committed to this effort and is ready to facilitate an end to the conflict. Obviously, a peaceful end to this conflict. An end that allows countries to secure their borders and lays the foundation for a thriving regional economy.
Rwanda has long been accused of propping up M23 fighters who've been steadily advancing in eastern DRC, exacerbating an already catastrophic humanitarian situation. Over 7,000 people have been killed since the start of the year, over 1 million others forcibly displaced. Jan Egeland, as Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, you just recently returned from the eastern DRC. If you can end this conversation by talking about the gravity of the situation there and what needs to happen as the U.S. once again, a kind of reprise of a very shameful history, is working on a mineral deal with the DRC.
The Democratic Republic of Congo has been in turmoil, in fighting now for more than a generation, and especially in the eastern part of the country. And it has also, like Sudan, had a lot of attention in the past. Now, neglect, really. I was in Goma, which is the capital of the eastern part of DRC and the provinces of Kivu, fully under control of this rebel group, the M23. They have taken not only Goma, which was more than 2 million people, but also Bukavu, more than a million people in South Kivu. Paradoxically, by them controlling the whole area, people can now return home. So for the first time in my many years of traveling to eastern Congo, many people had returned home, 1.8 million. I met them in four communities where the Norwegian Refugee Council is helping them reintegrate on their ancestral land. We will give them seeds. We will help them with farming and with education and with water again. They're happy to be back. But 1.2 million others were displaced by the recent fighting when M23 took this territory from the central government army. So I hope the U.S. will really do two things. Resume being the largest aid provider to the Democratic Republic of Congo. Many of the aid organizations are dependent from 50 to 100% of their aid operations on the U.S. And when everything is cut overnight, of course, it has a devastating impact. And even now, when we could help people home and we could solve some of the problems. And the minerals, yes, I mean, these people are among the poorest in the world. They're among the most abused, and they live on top of the incredible mineral riches that have been plundered by so many companies, so many colonial powers, so many of the neighbors of DRC. I hope the U.S. will really make sure that there is an equitable deal that can benefit the people, but that can only happen if there is a peace agreement, and that has to involve the central government, the Rwanda neighboring country, Uganda, Burundi, and the largest rebel groups, including M23.
Jan Egeland, I want to thank you for being with us, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, and Emtithel Mahmoud, the Darfurian refugee, Sudanese-American poet and humanitarian, activist, former refugee. We will link to your piece as well. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, one day everyone will have been against this. We'll speak with the award-winning author Omar El-Akhed. Stay with us. Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
One day, everyone will have always been against this. That's the title of the new book by award-winning author and journalist Omar El-Akhed. The book is a powerful reckoning with the West amidst its monumental moral failures as the war on Gaza has unfolded.
Omar El-Akhed is also the author of two novels, the most recent titled What Strange Paradise. He's joining us now from Portland, Oregon. Omar, welcome to Democracy Now! This is a powerful, poetic, probing work. And why don't we start with that title? One day, everyone will have always been against this. Explain what you mean.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. I was thinking this was in late October of 2023. I was thinking about how I fit into this part of the world. I've been sort of attuned to the West from a very young age. I grew up on the culture of this part of the world. It's the reason I sound the way I do. And I was trying to figure out how I fit into this part of the world, given that it's my tax money that's killing those Palestinian kids, that I'm doing this. And I was thinking in terms of pattern recognition. I was thinking in terms of how it's very difficult to find someone today who will tell you that they were always in support of South African apartheid or segregation in this country, and how once it's safe enough, everyone can go back in hindsight and talk about how awful the awful thing was. And a lot of the book is about that, is about trying to think in those terms when you're still in the moment where the horrible thing is happening, where the slaughter is happening. And so the book comes out of that, and it's in large part trying to figure out my place in a society and in an ordering of the world where I happen to live on the launching side of the missiles. And as a result, it's very, very easy for me to look away. And what happens when you decide you're not going to look away?
Well, Omar, you also say that the book is quote, this is taken your words, this is an account of a fracture, you say about the book, a breaking away from the notion that the polite Western liberal ever stood for anything at all. If you could elaborate on what you mean by that and what Western liberal you have in mind.
To be perfectly honest, I mean, I have a previous version of myself in mind. I don't think there's a single thing in this book that is indicted or interrogated or autopsied in which I'm not personally complicit or haven't been at a certain point in my life. I mean, look, to be perfectly honest with you, for the majority of my time living in this country, I was very much one of those people who picked up the ballot and looked at who has the R next to their name and then voted for whoever had the D next to their name because, hey, lesser of two evils. And that's, I suppose, perfectly fine up until a point. Up until a point where you are waking up every morning, opening up your computer, and witnessing evidence of the worst things human beings can do to one another, and then being told, again, by the lesser of two evils, that this is necessary and that this is good. And I think at a certain point, there comes a kind of fracture. And look, I spent the last 2.5 months on the road doing the book tour for this book. And we had these massive audiences. And look, I draw about 5 people to my book events on average. I am not that guy. I don't draw hundreds of people. Most of your viewers have no idea who I am. It wasn't because of the book. It wasn't because of me. I think it's because a lot of people in this country and in the West in general have spent the last 1.5 years feeling like they're losing their minds, being told repeatedly that this grotesque atrocity after atrocity is something that they have to support, and that if they don't, they're the bad guys. And I think there's a kind of disconnect that eventually causes you to sever from this idea of, well, I'll just be the centrist and I'll vote for the lesser of two evils and so on and so forth. That works up until a point. And I think over the last 1.5 years, that's sort of fallen apart. And there's a lot of people who are deeply uncertain about where they stand now, given that they can no longer maintain this sort of veneer of centrism or mainstream liberalism that has failed so spectacularly time and time again.
Yeah, Omar, we'll definitely go back to that point because it's something that you also present very beautifully in the book, the demand for a kind of dissociation, which, as you say, in your own case, became at a certain point impossible to sustain, the contradiction. But if we could talk a little bit more about your own genealogy, the book is, of course, about this massive failure of the West, the kind of discomfort is too light a word, almost insanity that this split has produced in many people, including yourself, as you said, in on the one hand, seeing every day the worst, as you said, that humanity can do to one another, to humans can do to one another in Gaza, and at the same time hearing statements that either deny that something like that is happening at all or say that what's happening is absolutely essential to happen. You intersperse stories of your own childhood growing up, born in Egypt, raised in Qatar, until you moved to the West. Explain where you see your own story and how you've come to think of this, how that's important.
So when I was about 5 years old, my father had to get out of Egypt. The political situation was really bad. The economic situation was really bad. And we ended up in Qatar in the Middle East. And that's where I grew up. That's where I spent sort of my teenage years. And one of the things about growing up in a place like Qatar is that essentially all culture is censored to some degree. You know, the first time I watched Titanic, it was about 1 hour long and very poorly edited and took me a long time to realize that this had actually been sort of chopped to pieces by the government censors, you know, that sort of thing. And when you grow up in that kind of environment, the projection of what you need the other place to be becomes really, really important. And so my first thoughts about what the West is, what the United States is, aren't so much about what the place is as what it isn't. And so I can go there and these movies won't be censored, the music won't be censored. I can be left alone, I can go to the library and pick out whatever book I want. And so you project what you need to be, what you need the place to be onto the place. And that's how I first thought of the West. And I think for a long time, that's enough for me. One of the issues about finally coming to this part of the world, which I did when I was 16 years old, is that you then have to contend with what it actually is. And I think the reason I end up writing a book like this about this part of the world, as opposed to, say, about Egypt, is because I'm not criticizing something because I love to sit around and criticize. And I get all of the responses that have been essentially one version or another of, well, go back where you came from. I get that. I've been getting that for most of my life. But there is, to me, a sense of there being something worth saving here, of there being something really, really important, and that the avenue towards saving it and towards salvaging it cannot come independent of criticism, because I grew up in a place where that was the case. And I can tell you that complete abolishing of criticism accomplishes exactly what you think, which is nothing at all. And so to me, the reason to write something like this in the first place is because I know what it looks like when you excise all criticism and all dissent from a society. I know exactly what that looks like, and it is a terrifying thing.
Omar, I wanted to end on a specific point on Palestinian journalists. You write about the rightful indignation of the capture of Evan Gershkovich in Russia. And the world renunciation of that. He was held for about a year and a half. But then you talk about the comparison to the response to the deaths of Palestinian journalists when you say, when every last Palestinian journalist has been killed, maybe there'll never have been any Palestinian journalists at all. Talk about the response in both cases.
So I was a journalist. It's the only real job I've ever had. I was a journalist for 10 years, and I don't say anything I'm about to say in terms of trying to just blanket criticize the institution of journalism. I have immense respect for the vast majority of journalists. There's a chapter in the book about fear and about the idea of what that word means, because one morning I woke up and I found an audio recording of a Palestinian girl begging for her life before the car she was in was shot at least 355 times by Israeli soldiers. And then I read a column from a columnist who was scared about protesters at college campuses. And I can't use the word fear to describe both of those situations. If that word can be used to encompass the entirety of that spectrum, that word has no meaning at all. And the reason I bring this up is because the same is true of journalism. I am watching Palestinian journalists give their lives to report this information, and they are the sole source of news about what is happening in a killing field. And then I'm watching columnists and I'm watching reporters on this side of the planet essentially pretend that those folks don't exist because, hey, it's controversial and who knows, and maybe they're linked to Hamas and whatever. And I can't use the word journalism to describe all of that. I need a different word, because right now, while I'm watching such fundamental failures of journalism, I'm also watching some of the best examples of journalism in the world. And again, we go back to this idea of the disconnect, the dissociation, the chasm between two things. And for me, that's what it comes down to, is what does that word mean? Because it's describing two very different things right now.
And we're going to talk more about that in part two of our discussion, and we're going to post it online at democracynow.org. Omar El-Akhed is a journalist and award-winning author. His new book is just out. It's called One Day, Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
The Canadian Human Trafficking Hotline is now live to help victims and survivors get vital social and emergency services. If you need help or want to help stop human trafficking, call 1-833-900-1010.
You have tuned in to Open Mic. on CJSF Radio, broadcasting on 90.1 FM from Burnaby Mountain, BC.
Hope to see you there.